Mourners wearing red headbands and shouldering coffins at Mecca's holy grand mosque in the western deserts of Saudi Arabia. The picture they presented to fellow worshippers at dawn on Tuesday, November 20th, was not an uncommon one, because the mosque was a popular place to bless the dead. There would soon be more to bless. The mourners set their coffins down, opened the lids, and unpacked an arsenal of assault rifles and grenades. Their conspiracy was born from an Islamic study group at Saudi Arabia's University of Medina during the early 1970s. The group's leader, Juhayman al-Utaibi, had been discharged from the Saudi National Guard. He persuaded several hundred followers, many of them Yemenis and Egyptians who had been living in Saudi Arabia for years, that his Saudi brother-in-law, Mohammed Abdullah al-Qahtani, who had once studied theology, was the savior returned to earth to save all Muslims from their depredations. Juhayman attacked the Saudi royal family. Oil-added royal princes had seized land and squandered the state's money, he proclaimed. Some princes were drunkards who led a dissolute life in luxurious palaces. He had his facts right, but his prescriptions were extreme. The purpose of the Mahdi's return to earth was the purification of Islam and the liberation of Saudi Arabia from the royal family. Signaling a pattern of future Saudi descent, Juhayman was more Puritan than even Saudi Arabia's officially sanctioned Puritans. He sought bans on radio, television, and soccer. That November morning, impatient with traditional proselytizing, he chained shut the gates to the Grand Mosque, locking tens of thousands of stunned worshippers inside. The mosque's imam declined to ratify the new savior. Juhayman and his gang began shooting. Dozens of innocent pilgrims fell dead. Saudi Arabia did little in the early hours of this bizarre uprising to clarify for the Islamic world who was behind the assault. Every devout Muslim worldwide faced Mecca's black, cube-shaped Kaaba 5 times a day to pray. Now it had been captured by usurping invaders. But who were they, and what did they want? Saudi Arabia's government was disinclined to publicize its crises. Saudi officials were themselves uncertain initially about who had sponsored the attack. Fragmented eyewitness accounts and galloping rumors leaped from country to country, continent to continent. In Washington, Secretary of State Cyrus Vance dispatched an overnight cable to U.S. embassies worldwide on that Tuesday night, urging them to take precautions as the Mecca crisis unfolded. The State Department had painfully learned only weeks earlier about the vulnerability of its compounds and the speed at which American diplomats could face mobs inflamed by grievances real and imagined. Ambassador Hummel in Islamabad sorted through these cabled cautions the next morning. He did not regard Islamic radicalism as a significant threat to Americans in Pakistan. It never had been before. Still, the Islamabad CIA station had weeks earlier picked up indications from its sources that students at Qaid-e-Azam might be planning demonstrations at the embassy in support of the Iranian hostage takers in Tehran. As a result, Hummel had requested and received a small contingent of about 2 dozen armed Pakistani police over and above the embassy's normal security force. That squad was in place on Wednesday morning when rumors began to circulate in Islamabad and later on local radio stations that the United States and Israel stood behind the attack at the Grand Mosque. The rumor held that Washington and Tel Aviv had decided to seize a citadel of Islamic faith in order to neutralize the Muslim world. Absurd on its face, the rumor was nonetheless received as utterly plausible by thousands, if not millions, of Pakistanis. The Voice of America reported that as the riot in Mecca raged, President Carter had ordered U.S. Navy ships to the Indian Ocean as a show of force against the hostage takers in Tehran. With a little imagination, it wasn't hard to link the two news items. As the students at Qaid-e-Azam made their protest plans, The Muslim, an Islamabad daily, published a special edition that referred to the two hostile actions against the Muslim world by the imperialists and their stooges. General Zia had plans that day to promote civic advancement through Islamic values. He had decided to spend most of the afternoon in teeming Rawalpindi, adjacent to Islamabad, riding about on a bicycle. Zia intended to hand out Islamic pamphlets and advertise by example the simple virtues of self-propelled transport. And, of course, Where the military dictator went, so went most of Pakistan's military and security establishment. When the first distress calls went out from the U.S. Embassy later that day, much of Pakistan's army brass was unavailable. They were pedaling behind the boss on their bicycles. Gary Schroen stood by the window of his office preparing to close the curtains when a Pakistani rioter below raised a shotgun at him and blasted out the plate glass. He and a young Marine beside him had spotted the shooter just early enough to leap like movie stuntmen beyond the line of fire. The shotgun pellets smashed into the CIA station's plaster walls. They had no time now to destroy classified documents. Schroen and Lessard locked their case files and disguise materials in the station's suite behind a vault door, grabbed a pair of pump-action Winchester 1200 shotguns from a Marine gun case, and headed to the third-floor code room vault. By about 2 p.m., 139 embassy personnel and Pakistani employees had herded themselves inside, hoping for shelter from the mob. Within the vault, a young political officer had cleared off a desk and was busy writing by hand the flash cable that would announce the attack to Washington. As he wrote, embassy communications officers destroyed cryptography packages one by one to prevent them from falling into the hands of rioters. The vault echoed with the sound of a sledgehammer rhythmically descending on CIA code equipment. The wounded Marine, Stephen Crowley, lay unconscious and bleeding on the floor, tended by an embassy nurse. He was breathing with help from an oxygen tank. Crowley had been shot in the riot's early moments, and by now the protesters had swollen in number and anger, and had begun to rampage through every corner of the compound. They hurled Molotov cocktails into the Chancery's lower offices, setting files and furniture on fire. Entire wings of the building leaped in flames, particularly the paper-laden budget and finance section located directly underneath the communications vault, which began to cook like a pot on a bonfire. Onlookers at the British Embassy estimated that at the height of the action, 15,000 Pakistani rioters swarmed the grounds. Marine Master Gunnery Sergeant Miller, or the Gunny as he was called, directed the defense from his post in the lobby. There he watched as rioters rushed through the now mangled front door no more than 15 feet away. They scurried into the lobby carrying bundles of wood, buckets of gasoline, and matches. Miller repeatedly requested permission for his men to fire on the arsonists, but each time the embassy's administrative counselor, David Fields, denied the request on the grounds that shooting would only further incite the riot. Miller had to content himself with rolling out more tear gas canisters as fire engulfed the building he was sworn to protect. When the lobby had completely filled with smoke, the Marines retreated upstairs to join the rest of the embassy staff in the third-floor vault. Just before going in, they dropped a few final tear gas canisters down each of the stairwells in the hope that would dissuade the rioters from climbing to the embassy's last remaining refuge. Outside at the motor pool, the rioters poured gasoline into embassy cars and set them burning one after another. In all, more than 60 embassy vehicles would go up in flames. Some rioters attacked the embassy residences, a cluster of modest brick townhouses that were home to mid-level American personnel and their families. Qaid-e-Azam University student leaders rounded up a group of hostages from these quarters and announced their intention to drive them to the campus to put them on trial as American spies. An enterprising Pakistani police lieutenant, one of the few guards who had refused to surrender his weapon to the mob in the riot's earliest moments, pretended to go along with the students' plan, loaded the hostages into a truck, and promptly drove them off to safety. He was not the only Pakistani to risk himself for the Americans. At the American school in Islamabad, several miles away from the embassy, a retired army colonel armed an impromptu squad of Pakistani guards with cricket bats and broomsticks. They successfully beat off rioters who attacked the school while children lay cowering in locked rooms. Although these and other individuals acted heroically, Pakistan's government did not. Despite dozens of pleas from Arthur Hummel, the ambassador, and John Reagan, the CIA station chief, hour after hour passed, and still no Pakistani troops or police arrived to clear the rioters. By mid-afternoon, enormous black clouds of gasoline-scented smoke poured out from the American compound, visible from miles away. Many of the rioters joined the melee spontaneously. but as the rampage unfolded, it also revealed evidence of substantial coordinated planning. On the embassy grounds, CIA personnel spotted what appeared to be riot organizers wearing distinctive sweater vests and carrying weapons. Some were Arabs, likely members of the sizable Palestinian population at Qaid e-Azam. The speed with which so many rioters descended on the embassy also suggested advanced preparation. Thousands arrived in government-owned Punjab Transport Corporation buses. Rioters turned up nearly at once at multiple American locations: the embassy compound, the American school, American information centers in Rawalpindi and Lahore, and several American businesses in Islamabad. Professors at Qaid e-Azam later reported that some students had burst into classrooms very early in the morning, before the rumor about American involvement in the Grand Mosque uprising had spread very far, shouting that students should attack the embassy to take vengeance in the name of Islam. Around 4 p.m., Pakistani Army headquarters finally dispatched a helicopter to survey the scene. It flew directly above the embassy, its whirring rotors fanning flames that raked the building. Then the helicopter flew away. Zia's spokesman later said the smoke had been too thick to make a visual assessment. The CIA reported that its sources in Zia's circle told a different story. When the helicopter returned to base, the crew advised Zia that the fire in the embassy was so hot and so pervasive that there was no way the American personnel inside could have survived. Since it seemed certain that the Americans had all been killed, there was no sense in risking further bloodshed and a possible domestic political cataclysm by sending army troops to forcibly confront the Islamist rioters. According to the CIA's later reports, Zia decided that, since he couldn't save the Americans inside the embassy anyway, he might as well just let the riot burn itself out. By this time, the Americans and Pakistanis in the vault were nearing the end of their tolerance. They had been inside for more than 2 hours, and there was no rescue in sight. In the State Department's chamber, they lay drenched with sweat and breathing shallowly through wet paper towels. Tear gas had blown back to the third floor, and some were gagging and vomiting. Temperatures rose as fires in the offices below burned hotter. Carpet seams burst from the heat, floor tiles blistered and warped. In the adjacent CIA code room, Miller, Schroen, Lessard, and a crew of CIA officers and Marine guards stared at a bolted hatch in the ceiling that led up to the roof. They wondered if they should try to force the hatch open and lead everyone to the fresh air above. A previous Islamabad station chief had installed the hatch for just this purpose. But about an hour into the attack, the rioters had discovered the passageway. They pounded relentlessly on the iron lid with pieces of a brick wall they had torn apart, hoping to break in. Some rioters poked their rifles into nearby ventilation shafts and shot. The sound of bullets crashing down from above was occasionally punctuated by even more jolting explosions as the fire crept up on oxygen tanks stored elsewhere in the building. The group in the code room listened to the metallic clanging on the hatch for about an hour. Then one of the CIA communications specialists, an engineer of sorts, came up with a plan to wire a heavy-duty extension cord into the iron cover. "Those guys up there, I'm going to electrocute them," he announced gleefully, as Gary Schroen later recalled it. He stripped to the waist and began to sweat as he attached large alligator clips to the hatch. "Now I'm going to plug this baby in, and the electricity's going to kill them." He was filthy and covered with bits of shredded documents. He thrust the plug into the wall. 400 volts of current seemed to fly up to the hatch, bounce off, and fly right back into the wall where it exploded in sparks and smoke. "God damn it! The resistance is too much!" The idea had seemed dubious from the beginning. The device wasn't even grounded properly. And there was laughter for the first time all afternoon when it failed. But what other options did they have? The heat had grown unbearable inside the vault. "What are we going to do?" they asked. "They're up there. What are we going to do?" Another hour passed. Slowly the hatch bent under the rioters' bricks. The concrete around it began to crumble into the code room. The CIA officers and Marines estimated they had about 30 minutes before the cover collapsed. But suddenly the banging stopped, and the voices on the roof quieted. After a few minutes of silence, the gunny decided, "Let's open the hatch and we'll face what happens, he said. The ambassador had given them the go-ahead to fire first, to maintain security in the vault, and they had enough weaponry to make it a battle if it came to that. Lessard and Schroen climbed ladders and popped the hatch halfway off. Half a dozen colleagues crouched below, shotguns primed, as Schroen recalled it, ready to shoot as soon as the rioters poured in.
Guys, guys! When we open the hatch, if somebody's up there, we're going to drop down, then shoot. Don't shoot first!
They worked out a plan for sequential firing. Schroen looked across the ladder at Lessard. We're going to die here if anybody...
Yeah, I think so, Gary.
But they couldn't open the hatch. They beat on the bolt, but the contraption was now so bent and warped that it wouldn't pop. They pushed and pushed, but there was nothing they could do. The sun set on Islamabad, and the noises outside began to drift off into the chilly November air. It was now about 6:30 p.m. Maybe the rioters were gone, or maybe they were lying in wait for the Americans to try to escape. David Fields, the administrative counselor, decided it was time to find out. He ordered the gunny to lead an expedition out the third-floor hallway and up onto the roof. Fields told them they had the authority to fire on any rioters who got in their way. Miller and his team of five sneaked out of the vault and into a hallway thick with smoke. They ran their hands along the curved hallway wall to keep track of their position and felt their way to the end, where a staircase led to the roof. The locked metal door normally guarding access to the stairs had been torn off its hinges. The rioters had already been here. With shotguns and revolvers locked and loaded, Miller cautiously guided his team up the stairs. As he poked his head out onto the roof, he fully expected a shootout. Instead, he saw a single Pakistani running toward him with hands raised high in the air and yelling, "Friend! Friend!" Miller gave the man a quick pat-down and found a copy of Who's Who in the CIA stuffed in one of his pockets, suggesting that student leaders had planned Tehran-style to arrest their own nest of spies. Miller took the book and told the straggler to get lost. The gunny would not fire his weapon that day, nor would any of the Marines under his command. The riot had finally dissipated. During the last hour, it had degenerated gradually into a smoky, sporadic carnival of looting. A few minutes after the expedition party set out, those still inside the vault heard the sound of the hatch being wrenched from above. An enormous U.S. Marine with hands like mallets ripped it off its moorings. Soon everyone from the CIA code room was up on the roof and staring over the chancery walls. Through the halo of smoke that ringed the building, they looked across the embassy grounds and saw bright leaping flames where some of their homes had once stood. All of the embassy compound's six buildings, constructed at a cost of $20 million, had been torched beyond repair. Using bicycle racks stacked end to end, the Marines set up makeshift ladders and led the large group huddled in the vault to safety. It was now dark and cold, and the footing was precarious. Vehicle lights and embers from fires illuminated the ground in a soft glow. Some Pakistani army troops had finally arrived. They were standing around inside the compound, mostly watching. When the last of those in the vault had been helped down, the gunny turned to climb the ladder. The CIA men asked where he was going. "I've got to go get Steve," he said. "I'm not going to leave my man up there." Minutes later, he emerged with Crowley's inert form wrapped in a blanket, slung across his shoulder. Crowley had died when the oxygen supply in the vault ran out. In flickering light, the gunny carried the body down the ladder to the ground. All reports indicate all of the people in the compound have been removed and taken to safety thanks to the Pakistani troops, State Department spokesman Hodding Carter told reporters in Washington later that day. In a telephone call, President Carter thanked Zia for his assistance, and Zia expressed regret about the loss of life. The Pakistani ambassador in Washington accepted the Americans' gratitude and noted that Pakistani army troops had reacted promptly, with dispatch. Secretary of State Cyrus Vance hurriedly summoned ambassadors from 30 Islamic countries to discuss the Pakistan embassy attack and its context. Asked about the recent wave of Islamic militancy abroad, Vance said, "It's hard to say at this point whether a pattern is developing."
It took a day or two to sort out the dead and missing. Poocher, the kidnapped auditor, was released by the students at Kaid Iazam around midnight. They had called him an imperialist pig and found America guilty of the trouble in Mecca and all the world's problems, but they decided in the end that he was personally innocent. He wandered back to the embassy, wounded and shaken. Rescue workers found two Pakistani employees of the embassy in a first-floor office. They had died of apparent asphyxiation, and their bodies had been badly burned. In the compound's residential section, workers found an American airman, Brian Ellis, 29, lying dead on the floor of his fire-gutted apartment. A golf club lay beside him. He had apparently been beaten unconscious and left to burn. On Friday, a Pan American Airlines jumbo jet evacuated 309 non-essential personnel, dependents, and other Americans from Pakistan and back to the United States. Saudi Arabian soldiers and French commandos routed the armed attackers at the Grand Mosque on Saturday in a bloody gun battle. The Saudis never provided an accounting of the final death toll. Most estimates placed it in the hundreds. Saudi Interior Minister Prince Naif downplayed the uprising's significance, calling the Saudi renegades no more than a criminal deviation who were far from having any political essence. Surviving followers of the Mahdi, who had been shot dead, fled to the mosque's intricate network of basements and underground tunnels. They were flushed out by Saudi troops after a further week of fighting. The building contractor, who had originally reconstructed the mosque for the Saudi royal family, reportedly supplied blueprints that helped security forces in this final phase of the battle. The Bin Laden brothers for contracting and industry were, after all, one of the kingdom's most loyal and prosperous private companies. The American Treasury Secretary, William Miller, flew into the kingdom amid the turmoil. He hoped to reassure Saudi investors, who had about $30 billion on deposit in U.S. banks, that America would remain a faithful ally. He also urged the Saudi royal family to use their influence with OPEC to hold oil prices in check. Rising gasoline prices had stoked debilitating inflation and demoralized the American people. Saudi princes feared the Mecca uprising reflected popular anxiety about small westernizing trends that had been permitted in the kingdom during recent years. They soon banned women's hairdressing salons and dismissed female announcers from state television programs. New rules stopped Saudi girls from continuing their education abroad. Prince Turki Al-Faisal, the Saudi intelligence chief, concluded that the Mecca uprising was a protest against the conduct of all Saudis, the sheikhs, the government, and the people in general. There should be no future danger or conflict between social progress and traditional religious practices, Turki told visitors, as long as the Saudi royal family reduced corruption and created economic opportunities for the public. In Tehran, the Ayatollah Khomeini said it was a great joy for us to learn about the uprising in Pakistan against the USA. It is good news for our oppressed nation. Borders should not separate hearts. Khomeini theorized that because of propaganda, people are afraid of superpowers, and they think that the superpowers cannot be touched. This, he predicted, would be proven false. The riot had sketched a pattern that would recur for years. For reasons of his own, the Pakistani dictator, General Zia, had sponsored and strengthened a radical Islamic partner, in this case, Jamaat and its student wing, that had a virulently anti-American outlook. This Islamist partner had veered out of control. By attacking the American embassy, Jamaat had far exceeded Zia's brief. Yet Zia felt he could not afford to repudiate his religious ally. And the Americans felt they could not afford to dwell on the issue. There were larger stakes in the U.S. relationship with Pakistan. In a crisis-laden, impoverished Islamic nation like Pakistan, on the verge of acquiring nuclear weapons, there always seemed to be larger strategic issues for the United States to worry about than the vague, seemingly manageable dangers of political religion. On the night of the embassy's sacking, Zia gently chided the rioters in a nationally broadcast speech. "I understand that the anger and grief over this incident were quite natural," he said, referring to the uprising in Mecca.
But the way in which they were expressed is not in keeping with the lofty Islamic traditions of discipline and forbearance. As the years passed, Zia's partnership with Jamaat would only deepen. The CIA and State Department personnel left behind in Islamabad felt deeply embittered. They and more than 100 of their colleagues had been left to die in the embassy vault. It had taken Pakistani troops more than 5 hours to make what was at maximum a 30-minute drive from Army headquarters in Rawalpindi. Had events taken a slight turn for the worse, the riot would have produced one of the most catastrophic losses of American life in U.S. diplomatic history. The CIA's Islamabad station now lacked vehicles in which to meet its agents. The cars had all been burned by mobs. Gary Schroen found a Qaid-e-Azam University jeep parked near the embassy, a vehicle apparently left behind by the rioters. Schroen hotwired it so that he could continue to drive out at night for clandestine meetings with his reporting agents. Soon, university officials turned up at the embassy to ask after the missing jeep. The university now wanted it back. Schroen decided that he couldn't afford to drive around Islamabad in a vehicle that was more or less reported as stolen. He drove the jeep one night to a lake on Islamabad's outskirts. There he got out and rolled it under the water. Small satisfaction, but something. 2. Lenin taught us. Yuri Andropov was a rising force within the gray cabal that circled the Kremlin's listless dawn, the hound-faced Leonid Brezhnev, General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. At 65, Andropov knew, or thought he knew, how to smother a rebellion. As a young communist apparatchik, he had soared to prominence as ambassador to Budapest when Soviet troops crushed the 1956 Hungarian uprising. He became KGB chief a decade later, managing the vast apparatus of Soviet internal security and external espionage. He was the leading spy in a political system constructed on deception. From his services headquarters in the Lubyanka on Moscow's Dzerzhinsky Square, Andropov oversaw KGB foreign covert operations, attempted penetrations of the CIA, and campaigned to suppress dissent within the Soviet Union. Ashen-faced, he conformed outwardly to the drab personal norms of collective leadership. Because he also read Plato, led drives against Soviet corruption, and mentored younger reformers such as Mikhail Gorbachev, a few Kremlin watchers in the West saw tiny glimmers of enlightenment in Andropov, at least in comparison to decaying elder statesmen such as Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko or Defense Minister Dmitry Ustinov. Yet Andropov's KGB remained ruthless and murderous at home and abroad. In Third World outposts such as Kabul, his lieutenants tortured and killed with impunity. Communist allies who fell out of favor were murdered or exiled. Political detainees languished by the hundreds of thousands in cruel gulags. Neither Andropov nor the KGB saw Afghanistan's anti-communist revolt coming. The first sharp mutiny erupted in Herat in March 1979, soon after Kabul's recently installed Marxists announced a compulsory initiative to teach girls to read. Such literacy drives were a staple of red-splashed Soviet propaganda posters shipped by the trainload to Third World client states. Women workers on the march, muscled and unsmiling, progressive and determined, chins jutted, staring into the future. Earlier in the century, as the Bolsheviks swept through the republics that became Soviet Central Asia, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, they had transformed pastoral Islamic societies into insistently godless police states. Women poured into factories and onto collective farms. So it would be in neighboring Afghanistan, the KGB's political specialists believed. For nearly two decades, the KGB had secretly funded and nurtured communist leadership networks at Kabul University and in the Afghan army, training and indoctrinating some 3,725 military personnel on Soviet soil. Afghan President Mohammad Daoud played Moscow and Washington against each other during the 1970s, accepting financial aid and construction projects from each in a precarious balancing act. In April 1978, Daoud fell off his beam. He arrested communist leaders in Kabul after they staged a noisy protest. Soviet-backed conspirators seated within the Afghan army shot him dead days later in a reception room of his tattered palace. Triumphant Afghan leftists ripped down the green-striped national flag and unfurled red banners across a rural and deeply religious nation barely acquainted with industrial technology or modernism. Hundreds of Soviet military and political advisers were barracked in Afghan cities and towns to organize secret police networks, army and militia units, small factories, and co-educational schools. Advised by the KGB, Kabul's Marxists launched a terror campaign against religious and social leaders who might have the standing to challenge communist rule. By 1979, about 12,000 political prisoners had been jailed. Systematic executions began behind prison walls. No less than America's modernizing capitalists, Russia's retrenching communists underestimated the Iranian Revolution. They failed initially to detect the virus of Islamist militancy spreading north and east from Tehran through informal underground networks. The Kremlin and its supporting academies possessed few experts on Islam. The Soviet Union's closest allies in the Middle East were secular regimes such as Syria and Iraq. Like the Americans, the Soviets had directed most of their resources and talent toward the ideological battlefields of Europe and Asia during the previous two decades. In the early spring of 1979, religious activists inspired by Khomeini's triumphant return carried their defiant gospel across Iran's open desert border with Afghanistan, particularly to Herat, an ancient crossroads on an open plain long bound to Iran by trade and politics. A Persian-accented desert town watered by the Hariboud River, Herat's traditional cultures and schools of Islam, which included prominent strains of mysticism, were not as severe toward women as in some rural areas of Afghanistan to the east, yet it was a pious city. Its population included many followers of Shiism, Iran's dominant Islamic sect. And, as elsewhere, even non-Shias found themselves energized in early 1979 by Khomeini's religious political revival. Oblivious, Kabul's communists and their Soviet advisers pressed secular reforms prescribed in Marxist texts. In addition to their literacy campaigns for girls, they conscripted soldiers and seized lands previously controlled by tribal elders and Islamic scholars. They abolished Islamic lending systems, banned dowries for brides, legislated freedom of choice within marriages, and mandated universal education in Marxist doctrine. A charismatic Afghan army captain named Ismail Khan called for jihad against the communist usurpers that March, and led his heavily armed Herat garrison into violent revolt. His followers hunted down and hacked to death more than a dozen Russian communist political advisers, as well as their wives and children. The rebels displayed Russian corpses on pikes along shaded city streets. Soviet-trained pilots flew bomber jets out of Kabul in vengeful reply, pulverizing the town in remorseless waves of attack. By the time the raids were finished, on the eve of its first anniversary in power, the Afghan communist government had killed as many as 20,000 of its own citizenry in Herat alone. Ismail Khan escaped and helped spread rebellion in the western countryside. As Herat burned, KGB officers seethed. Bearing in mind that we will be labeled as an aggressor, but in spite of that, under no circumstances can we lose Afghanistan, Andropov told a crisis session of the Soviet Politburo meeting secretly behind Moscow's Kremlin ramparts on March 17, 1979. Records of the Kremlin's private discussions in Moscow that spring, unavailable to Americans at the time, depict a Soviet leadership dominated by KGB viewpoints. Andropov was a rising figure as Brezhnev faded. His Kabul outpost, the KGB residency, as it was called, maintained many of the contacts and financial relationships with Afghan communist leaders, bypassing Soviet diplomats. The Afghans were confusing and frustrating clients, however. Andropov and the rest of Brezhnev's lieutenants found their Afghan communist comrades dense, self-absorbed, and unreliable. The Afghan Marxists had taken their Moscow-supplied revolutionary textbooks much too literally.
They were moving too fast. They had split into irreconcilable party factions, and they argued over petty privileges and arid ideology. "The problem," noted Ustinov at a March 18th Politburo meeting, "is that the leadership of Afghanistan did not sufficiently appreciate the role of Islamic fundamentalists. It is completely clear to us that Afghanistan is not ready at this time to resolve all of the issues it faces through socialism," Andropov acknowledged. "The economy is backward. The Islamic religion predominates, and nearly all of the rural population is illiterate. We know Lenin's teaching about a revolutionary situation. Whatever situation we are talking about in Afghanistan, it is not that type of situation." The group dispatched former Premier Alexei Kosygin to telephone the Afghan communist boss, Nur Mohammad Taraki, an inexperienced thug, to see if they could persuade him to steer a more measured course. Taraki had spent the first year of the Afghan communist revolution constructing a personality cult. He had printed and tacked up thousands of posters that displayed his photograph and described him as the great teacher. As his countrymen rose in mass revolt, Taraki maneuvered Afghan communist rivals into exile. He had confided at a Kabul reception for a KGB delegation that he saw himself directly following Lenin's example, forswearing any compromises with non-communist Afghans and seizing the early period of his revolution to establish a dictatorship of the proletariat based on the Soviet model. The murders of political prisoners underway in Kabul jails might be severe, Taraki once told his KGB handlers, but Lenin taught us to be merciless towards the enemies of the revolution, and millions of people had to be eliminated in order to secure the victory of the October Revolution in the Soviet Union in 1917. Kosygin placed the call to Taraki on March 18th in the midst of the Politburo's crisis sessions. "The situation is bad and getting worse," Taraki admitted. Herat was falling to the newly emerging Islamic opposition. The city was almost wholly under the influence of Shiite slogans. "Do you have the forces to rout them?" Kosygin asked. "I wish it were the case," Taraki said. The Afghan communists desperately needed direct Soviet military assistance, Taraki pleaded. "Hundreds of Afghan officers were trained in the Soviet Union. Where are they all now?" an exasperated Kosygin inquired. "Most of them are Muslim reactionaries. What else do they call themselves? The Muslim Brotherhood," Taraki said. "We are unable to rely on them. We have no confidence in them." Taraki had a solution, however. Moscow, he advised, should secretly send in regiments of Soviet soldiers drawn from its Central Asian republics. "Why can't the Soviet Union send Uzbeks, Tajiks, and Turkmens in civilian clothing?" Taraki pleaded. "No one will recognize them. They could drive tanks, because we have all these nationalities in Afghanistan. Let them don Afghan costume and wear Afghan badges, and no one will recognize them." Iran and Pakistan were using this clandestine method, Taraki believed, to foment the Islamic Revolution, infiltrating into Afghanistan their own regular troops disguised as guerrillas. "You are, of course, oversimplifying the issue," Kosygin sniffed. "Afghanistan's rising Islamic rebellion," he told Taraki, "presented a complex political and international issue." The CIA sent its first classified proposals for secret support to the anti-communist Afghan rebels to Jimmy Carter's White House in early March 1979, just as the revolt in Herat began to gather force. The options paper went to the Special Coordination Committee, an unpublicized cabinet subgroup that oversaw covert action on the president's behalf. The CIA's covering memo reported that Soviet leaders were clearly worried about the gathering Afghan revolt. It noted that Soviet-controlled media had launched a propaganda campaign to accuse the United States, Pakistan, and Egypt of secretly backing the Afghan Islamic insurgents. In fact, the United States had not done so until now. Perhaps this would be a good time to begin. The upheaval in Iran had created new vulnerabilities for the United States and the Middle East. The KGB might seek to exploit this chaos. Here was an opportunity to deflect some of the fire spreading from Khomeini's pulpit away from the United States
and toward the Soviet Union.
A sustained rebellion in Afghanistan might constrain the Soviets' ability to project power into Middle Eastern oil fields.
It also might embarrass and tie down Afghan and perhaps Soviet forces as they attempted to quell the uprising. Still, this was a risky course. The Soviets might retaliate if they saw an American hand in their Afghan cauldron. Carter's White House remained undecided about the CIA's initial options paper. On March 6th, the Special Coordination Committee asked the CIA to develop a second round of proposals for covert action. The CIA's chief analyst for Soviet affairs, Arnold Holick, wrote a worried memo to Admiral Stansfield Turner, the CIA's director. Holick feared that Taraki's communist regime might disintegrate, prompting the Soviets to intervene. A Soviet incursion might lead Pakistan, Iran, and perhaps China to augment secret support to the Afghan rebels. General Mohammad Zia-ul-Haq in Pakistan might then ask the United States to openly oppose or deter any Soviet military thrust across Pakistan's border. Here was a scenario for the outbreak of World War III, with all of its horrifying potential for nuclear escalation. As to Moscow's attitude toward the floundering Kabul communists, Holick concluded that, in at least some scenarios, the Soviets may well be prepared to intervene on behalf of the ruling group. As the CIA and KGB hurtled forward that spring, each had glimpses of the other's motivations, but neither fully understood the other's calculus. From CIA headquarters at Langley, clandestine service officers in the Near East Division reached out to Pakistani and Saudi contacts to explore what might be done on the ground inside Afghanistan. At last, some of the CIA officers felt, the agency was taking initiative. The exploration of an Afghan covert action plan, however tentative, seemed to these Near East hands a rare exception to what had become a dismal, defensive, passive period at the CIA. Widely publicized congressional hearings a few years before had exposed agency assassination plots in Cuba, rogue covert operations in Latin America, and other shocking secrets. An American public and Congress already outraged about governmental abuses of power after Watergate had turned on the CIA, creating a hostile political environment for agency operations. Assassinations had been formally and legally banned by executive order. New laws and procedures had been enacted to ensure presidential and congressional control over CIA covert actions. Inside Langley, the reforms produced anger and demoralization among the professional spy cadres, and even among those who welcomed some of the changes. The CIA had only been doing its job, following presidential directives, sometimes at great personal risk to the officers involved, many at Langley felt. Now there was a sense in Washington that the agency had all along been a kind of criminal organization, a black hole of outrageous conspiracies. By 1979, the public and congressional backlash far exceeded the scale of the original abuses, many career CIA officers believed. Meanwhile, Jimmy Carter had sent a team of brass-polished outsiders, led by Navy Admiral Turner, to whip them into shape. To cut the CIA's budget, Turner had issued pink slips to scores of clandestine service case officers, the first substantial layoffs in the agency's history. Inside the Directorate of Operations, it felt as if they had hit rock bottom. As they probed for options in Afghanistan that spring, officers in the CIA's Near East Division reported that General Zia in Pakistan might be willing to step up his existing low-level clandestine support for the Afghan insurgents. The general was concerned, however, that unless the United States committed to protect Pakistan from Soviet retaliation, they could not risk Soviet wrath by increasing support to the anti-communist rebels too much, the CIA officers reported. Diplomatic relations between the United States and Pakistan had reached a nadir in 1979, but the CIA had kept its liaison channels in Islamabad open. Zia understood that no matter how sternly Jimmy Carter might denounce him in public because of his poor human rights record or his secret nuclear program, he had backdoor influence in Washington through the CIA. Khomeini's victory early in the year had led to the loss of vital American electronic listening stations based in Iran and trained on the Soviet Union. Zia had accepted a CIA proposal to locate new facilities in Pakistan. For decades, There had been these sorts of layers within layers in the U.S.-Pakistani relationship. During the 1960s, the first American U-2 spy planes had flown secretly out of Peshawar air bases. During the early 1970s, Henry Kissinger had used Pakistani intermediaries to forge his secret opening to China. For his part, Zia saw covert operations as the most prudent way to pursue his regional foreign policy and military objectives. Pakistan had lost half its territory in a war with India 8 years earlier. It was too small and too weak a country to openly challenge its neighbors with military force. Zia preferred to strike and hide. Jimmy Carter's deputy national security advisor, David Aaron, chaired a second secret session of the Special Coordination Committee on March 30th to consider direct American covert aid to the Afghan rebellion. It was just 2 weeks after Kosygin's stalemated telephone conversation with Taraki. The State Department's David Newsom explained to the group that the Carter administration now sought to reverse the current Soviet trend and presence in Afghanistan, to demonstrate to the Pakistanis our interest and concern about Soviet involvement, and to demonstrate to the Pakistanis, Saudis, and others our resolve to stop extension of Soviet influence in the Third World. But what steps, exactly, should they take? Should they supply guns and ammunition to defecting Afghan army units? How would the Soviets react? Aaron posed the central question. Is there interest in maintaining and assisting the insurgency, or is the risk that we will provoke the Soviets too great? They decided to keep studying their options. Within days, Afghan army officers in Jalalabad followed Ismail Khan's example and mutinied against the communists, murdering Soviet advisers. Afghan commanders climbed into their tanks and rumbled over to the rebel lines, declaring themselves allies of the jihad. To Jalalabad's north, in a village of Kunar province known as Kerala, Afghan government forces accompanied by Soviet advisers carried out a massacre of hundreds of men and boys. As word of this and other executions spread in the Afghan countryside, defections and desertions from government army units mounted. Week by week that spring, the communist-led army melted with the snow, its conscripts sliding away into the rock canyons and pine-forested mountains where Mujahideen, holy warrior rebel units, had begun to acquire large swaths of uncontested territory. Most analysts at CIA and other American intelligence agencies continued to predict that the Soviet forces would not invade to quell the rebellion. As summer neared, the CIA documented shipments of attack helicopters from the Soviet Union to Afghanistan and described increasing involvement by Soviet military advisers on the ground. But Langley's analysts felt the Politburo would try to minimize direct involvement. So did the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. Under foreseeable circumstances, predicted a secret cable from the embassy on May 24th, the Soviet Union will probably avoid shouldering a substantial part of the anti-insurgency combat. The cable accurately reflected the mood inside the Kremlin. The KGB's Andropov, along with Gromyko and Ustinov, formed a working group that spring to study the emerging crises in Afghan communism. None of their options seemed attractive. They completed a top-secret report for Brezhnev on June 28. The Afghan revolution was struggling because of economic backwardness, the small size of the working class, and the weakness of the local Communist Party, as well as the selfishness of its Afghan leaders, they concluded. Andropov's team drafted a letter to great teacher Taraki, urging him to stop squabbling with his rivals. They instructed him to involve more comrades in revolutionary leadership and soften his stance toward Islam. They advised him to work at recruiting mullahs onto the communist payroll and convincing the broad number of Muslims that the socio-economic reforms will not affect the religious beliefs of Muslims. For his part, Taraki preferred guns. He still wanted Soviet troops to confront the rebels. In Washington that week, National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, the son of a Polish diplomat whose family was forced into exile by the Nazi invasion and later by Soviet occupation, recommended that President Carter endorse non-lethal covert support for the Afghan rebels. There were too few opportunities to embarrass the Soviets in the Third World, Brzezinski believed. One had now presented itself in Afghanistan. The risks could be managed. Brzezinski's plan was a compromise that bridged unresolved arguments within the Special Coordination Committee. The CIA would funnel support to the Afghan insurgents, but no weapons would be supplied, for now. On July 3, 1979, Carter scrawled his name on a presidential finding required under a recent law intended to ensure White House control over CIA operations. Under the new system, if the CIA intended to undertake special activities designed to influence political conditions abroad, as opposed to its more routine work of espionage or stealing secrets, the president had to find, or declare formally and in writing, that such covert action promoted American national security. The president also had to notify a handful of congressional leaders of his decision. Carter's finding authorized the CIA to spend just over $500,000 on propaganda and psychological operations, as well as provide radio equipment, medical supplies, and cash to the Afghan rebels. Using intermediaries in Germany and elsewhere to disguise their involvement, CIA officers from the Near East Division began that summer to ship medical equipment and radios to Pakistan, where they were passed to Zia's intelligence service for onward distribution to the Afghan guerrillas. It seemed, at the time, a small beginning. Despite Moscow's pleas for common sense, Kabul's Marxist leaders began to consume themselves. By late summer, great teacher Taraki had become locked in deadly rivalry with a party comrade, Hafizullah Amin, a former failed graduate student at Columbia University in New York, and a leading architect of Afghanistan's 1978 communist revolution. Each soon concluded that the other had to go. Amin managed to oust Taraki from office in September. A few weeks later, he ordered Taraki's death. The great teacher perished in a fusillade of gunfire inside a barricaded Kabul compound. Hafizullah Amin's ascension launched a tragicomedy of suspicion and miscalculation within the KGB. KGB handlers working out of the Kabul residency had kept both Taraki and Amin on their payroll for years, sometimes meeting their clients secretly in parked cars on the city's streets. After Amin gained power, however, he became imperious. Among other transgressions, he sought authority from the KGB to withdraw funds from Afghanistan's foreign bank accounts, which had about $400 million on deposit, according to KGB records. Frustrated and hoping to discredit him, the KGB initially planted false stories that Amin was a CIA agent. In the autumn, these rumors rebounded on the KGB in a strange case of blowback, the term used by spies to describe planted propaganda that filters back to confuse the country that first set the story loose. For reasons that remain unclear, Amin held a series of private meetings in Kabul that fall with American diplomats. When the KGB learned of these meetings, its officers feared that their own false rumors about Amin might be true. A document from India circulating that autumn noted that when he lived in New York, Amin had been affiliated with the Asia Foundation, which had a history of contacts with the CIA. As the weeks passed, some KGB officers examined the possibility that Amin might be an American plant sent to infiltrate the Afghan Communist Party. They also picked up reports that Amin might be seeking a political compromise with Afghanistan's Islamic rebels. Of course, this was the approach the KGB itself had been urging on Taraki from Moscow earlier in the year. Now, suddenly, it looked suspicious. KGB officers feared Amin might be trying to curry favor with America and Pakistan. The KGB sent a written warning to Brezhnev about Amin in November. The Kabul residency feared an intended shift of Afghan foreign policy to the right, meaning into closer alignment with the United States. Amin has met with the U.S. chargé d'affaires a number of times, but he has given no indication of the subject of these talks in his meetings with Soviet representatives. For their part, the Americans in Kabul regarded Amin as a dangerous tyrant. They held Amin partly responsible for the murder of Adolf Dubs, the American ambassador to Afghanistan, who had been kidnapped and shot to death in a Kabul hotel room earlier in 1979. Still, U.S. diplomats inside the embassy were aware of the rumors that Amin was a CIA agent. There was enough concern and confusion about this question among State Department diplomats in the embassy that, before his murder, Ambassador Dubs had asked his CIA station chief point-blank whether there was any foundation to the rumors. He was told emphatically that Amin had never worked for the CIA, according to J. Bruce Amstutz, who was Dubs' deputy at the time and became U.S. chargé d'affaires after his death. Officers in the Near East Division of the CIA, who would have handled Amin if he were on the agency payroll, also said later that they had no contacts with him when he lived in New York or later, other than casual discussions at diplomatic receptions. No evidence has yet surfaced to contradict these assertions. That fateful autumn, however, Amstutz did meet 5 times with Amin in private. Their discussions were stilted and unproductive, Amstutz recalled years later. Far from tilting toward the United States, Amstutz found the Afghan communist leader uncompromisingly hostile. Amin had 2 times failed his doctoral examination at Columbia, and in Amstutz's estimation, this humiliation left him angry and resentful toward Americans. CIA officers working in the Kabul station concentrated most of their efforts on Soviet targets, not Afghan communists. Their principal mission in Kabul for years had been to steal Soviet military secrets, especially the operating manuals of new Soviet weapons systems, such as the MiG-21 fighter jet. They also tried to recruit KGB agents and communist bloc diplomats onto the agency's payroll. Toward this end, the CIA case officers joined a 6-on-6 international soccer league for spies and diplomats sponsored by the German club in Kabul. The officers spent comparatively little time cultivating Afghan sources or reporting on intramural Afghan politics. As a result, the CIA had failed to predict Afghanistan's initial 1978 communist coup. The agency still had relatively few Afghan sources. "What are the Soviets doing in Afghanistan?" asked a top-secret code word memorandum sent to National Security Advisor Brzezinski by Thomas Thornton in September 1979 that drew on all available U.S. intelligence. "Simply, we don't know," the memo began. The KGB fared no better in assessing American intentions. Knowing that Amin had been meeting with U.S. diplomats in secret but unable to learn the content of those discussions, KGB officers concluded that the CIA had begun to work with Amin to manipulate Kabul's government. The KGB officers in Afghanistan then convinced their superiors in Moscow that drastic measures had to be undertaken. Amin should be killed or otherwise removed from office to save the Afghan revolution from CIA penetration. In a personal memorandum to Brezhnev, KGB chief Andropov explained why. "After the coup and the murder of Taraki in September of this year, the situation in the party, the army, and the government apparatus has become more acute, as they were essentially destroyed as a result of the mass repressions carried out by Amin. At the same time, alarming information started to arrive about Amin's secret activities, forewarning of a possible political shift to the West. These included," Andropov wrote, "contacts with an American agent about issues which are kept secret from us." In Andropov's fevered imagination, the CIA's recruitment of Amin was part of a wider unfolding plot by the agency to create a new great Ottoman Empire, including the southern republics of the Soviet Union. With a base secured in Afghanistan, the KGB chief feared, as he wrote confidentially, that the United States could point Pershing nuclear missiles at the Soviet Union's southern underbelly, where its air defenses were weak. Iran and Pakistan might go nuclear as well, with American support, and push into Central Asia. To prevent this, Andropov advised, the Soviet Union must act decisively to replace Amin and shore up Afghan communism. In the end, Andropov and the rest of Brezhnev's inner circle concluded the best way to achieve these goals would be to assassinate Amin and mount a military invasion of Afghanistan, installing new and more responsive Afghan communist leaders. KGB fears about Amin's reliability were by no means the only factor in this decision. Without direct military support from Moscow, the broader Afghan government faced collapse because of desertions from its army. If communism in Afghanistan was to be saved, Moscow had to act decisively. Yet Politburo records also make clear that KGB fears about Amin's loyalty played a role in this analysis. The questions about Amin accelerated the timetable for decision-making, encouraged the Politburo's inner circle to think they faced devious CIA intrigues in Kabul,